This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for Money, Riches, and Wealth. Here's your host, Drew Tignanelli.
This is Drew Tignanelli here with Money, Riches, and Wealth. Christopher John O'Shea with me tonight. How are you?
Yes, sir. Doing great.
That's good.
How about you?
I'm doing fantastic. And we have a guest tonight. And the article that we read that encouraged us to want to invite him is America Can't Escape the Debt Vortex. And fortunately, I'm a Star Trek fan, so I knew what a vortex was. But other than that, you know, I would have had to look it up. But anyway, go ahead, Chris.
Yes, that is the reason that caused us to do that. And while we're on the subject and we interacted with George Malone, he's written a new book. And the book is called When the New Deal Came to Town, A Snapshot of a Place and Time with Lessons for Today. And so I'm just going to read a little bit from, for those who don't know him, I've read George Malone's writings in the Wall Street Journal for 30 years. You know, he retired after a 54-year writing and editing career at the Wall Street Journal. He moved to New York in 1962 to join the journal's Page One department as an editor. From 66 to 70, he was a foreign correspondent based in London, covering such major stories as the Six-Day War in the Middle East, the Biafran War in Nigeria, and attempted economic reform in the Soviet Union. He was the winner of the Gerald Leib Award for Distinguished Business and Financial Journalism in 1982, and twice in the 80s won the Daily Gleaner Award of the Inter-American Press Association for his writings about the rising Soviet influence in Central America. He's seen a lot. He's written a lot. And it's just a real delight to have him as our guest tonight. George.
George, are you there?
Well, thank you very much, Chris.
Thank you, George. We really appreciate you being with us. And let's just start with this article, America Can't Escape the Debt Vortex. And you say that the U.S. Total obligation to U.S. have hit 370% of GDP. And you see that as a potential critical point that this country's at. Yes?
Well, I think so. I mean, debt, you know, we sometimes sort of take debt for granted.
But that is true.
But it does have consequences. And it's getting very high, both the debt owed by the federal government and the states, but by individuals and businesses. They've all been going up very rapidly. And the problem with debt is at some point you kind of get stocked up on debt and you have to stop borrowing, and that slows down the economy.
Yeah. Now, Chris, you helped me remember, what's the name of that liberal economist that they love to talk about who thinks that you can just borrow money forever? You know, the guy that's been...
I think Keynes kind of had that idea.
Well, that was Keynes. He was the past guy.
Too much to him.
I'm talking about the guy currently that they all turn to, and he talks about just running up deficits to whatever.
Well, I mean, the guy that I read a lot, and I really, you know, it's hard for me to read any of his articles without pulling my hair out, Alan Blinder's always writing stuff.
No, not
but
Alan
I don't think
Blinder.
It's Blinder who
it's
you're thinking
of. The other
of.
One. Gosh, how can I not remember him? I'll remember him before this show's over, trust me.
Sure.
Anyway,
okay.
You know, now Japan has, what, just 250% of debt to GDP just on their government debt. And so far they continue to plug along, maybe not great, but they're at least plugging along. How do you think of that? How do you analyze that?
Well, it's not only just the national debt, which has more than doubled during the last decade. In other words, we've accrued more debt in the last decade than in the entire history of the United States before then. So we've got that problem, and we still have the Fed running a very easy monetary policy in terms of interest rates, at least. So the government's getting its money almost free because the interest that the Federal Reserve obtains on the debt that they hold, which is enormous, goes back to the Treasury after they deduct their own expenses. So I have the feeling somehow that you can't just keep doing this forever.
Yeah, no, I agree wholeheartedly. How about, you know, now China has even, seems like they're going even worse than the United States. Would you agree with that?
Yes, this worries me quite a lot because the international capital markets and financial markets are intertwined in such a way that some kind of big bust in China could affect us as well. Of course, they hold a lot of our debt, for one thing, and I'm not sure in quite what way that would happen, but it might affect the Chinese banks are rather shaky. So to the extent that our banks have extended any credit to China, or anybody has extended credit to China, that could be a problem. So that's another one to keep an eye on.
Yeah. You know, the economist I was thinking about, and this one really pulls your hair out, worse than Alan Blinder, is Paul Krugman.
Oh, right.
Paul Krugman.
Oh, man. I don't even see how anybody...
economist. Okay.
Now, George, now, what I wanted to ask you is there was an article... And we're going to have to take a pause in about 40 seconds, so I'll just tee you up for this. There was an article in Bloomberg, and Bloomberg news articles drive me crazy, but this one was the worst I've ever seen. It says, the reverse Trump tax plan delivers an economic miracle in Sweden. It talks about the new prime minister who redistribution of income, raising taxes dramatically, going up to, I think, 75% of income and so forth. And they're talking about how wonderful Sweden's doing and so forth. Are you familiar with what's going on in Sweden right now?
Well, yes, they were doing well, but they were doing well for the opposite reason. They were going just the opposite way from what they're doing now. So the day of reckoning will be not long coming, probably for Sweden again.
Yeah,
they've been that route before.
So you're going to hold with us a second, George. We're going to be right back. We're going to talk more about this, and then we're going to get into your book, The New Deal, When the New Deal Came to Town. But right now, I've got to take a traffic pause. We'll be right back with Money, Riches, and Wealth.
Personal finance has become a major area of stress due to the increasing dangers and complexities of the global economy. Personal financial management is a comprehensive approach to combating these issues, and the financial physical is the first step. This is Drew Tignanelli, host of Money, Riches, and Wealth, and president of the Financial Consulate, an independent fee-only firm. The financial physical begins with an objective analysis of your personal finances and ends with a plan to help achieve your goals. Experience the difference of the financial physical and learn how personal financial management can revolutionize your financial well-being. To learn more about the financial physical and the other services we offer, call us at 410-823-SAVE. That's 410-823-7283, or the easy way to remember that, 410-823-SAFE, or visit us online at drewtig.com. That's drewtig.com. 75% of adults agree they could benefit from advice and answers to everyday financial questions from a professional. This is Drew Tignanelli, host of Money, Riches, and Wealth, and president of the Financial Consulate. We strive to serve as a leader in educating the public on personal finance topics through our Financial Pulse and Consulate Journal. For these publications and learn about our personal financial management services, visit our website at drewtig.com, and follow us on Twitter at the FinCon for educational updates.
Yeah. All right, we're back. Money, Riches, and Wealth. We're here with George Malone, and as Chris was reading earlier, George has a distinguished career in writing about economics for 50-some years, and it's a privilege to have you here with us, sir. Let me just ask you a question. Do you think Bernanke and Yellen are the saviors of the economy? Is what they did the right moves over the last 10 years?
No, I don't think so. I've had a lot of disagreement with Federal Reserve policy, not only in the last 10 years, but... sometimes in the past, but no, I think it was a mistake to go down to zero interest rates, and it was an even bigger mistake to launch the quantitative easing programs where they bought enormous quantities of federal debt. That just simply encouraged the Congress to run up a huge deficit, and as to the zero interest rates, yeah, it looks good to borrowers, maybe, But it doesn't look very good to people who are trying to make money on a pension fund or something, the people who are running pension funds for retirees, because they can't get a decent return on their investments. So that I think that answers the question. I disagree with Bernanke and Yellen.
I believe wholeheartedly that the low interest rates are causing deflation because you can't get any rate of return on the money you've saved and accumulated. And it's a vicious circle that they've created. You know, so they're trying to raise inflation, but they give you 0% on your money. How the heck do you ever make any money on that, you know?
Absolutely.
You're forcing people then who's looking for income, you're forcing them into riskier assets.
Yeah. So,
and the problem is that they have is how to get out of it.
Yeah.
Every time they try to raise interest rates or even talk about it, which they do constantly, they get a blip in the stock market, and that scares them off and so forth. So it's a very complicated subject. I'm not sure how much influence the Fed really does have over interest rates, but to the extent they do have influence, I don't think they're using it very well.
Yeah. So tell our listeners about some, you know, economic time, 1920s, when the economy crashed, went into sort of a depression, but really wasn't a very long depression, not the one that everyone's familiar with in 1929. I believe it was, 1921?
Yes, and Jim Grant has written a very good book about this, not much happened. You know, the stock market crashed, and the Thomas Mellon, the Treasury Secretary, supplied liquidity to the banks, and they didn't do much else. And the economy recovered, and we had a glorious 1920s period of wealth creation. And then we had another crash in 1929, and the government responded in just the opposite way by trying to do everything. And that, in my book, is what I talk about. It's kind of a revisionist history of the 1930s. Instead of arguing, as many New Deal economists have, that it was a failure of capitalism and FDR stepped in and saved it, my approach is that there was no failure of capitalism. The stock market crashed, and Hoover first, and then FDR intervened to such an extent that we had a whole decade of hard times.
Yeah, and Franklin Roosevelt's decisions of the 1930s are still impacting our economy in a tremendous way today.
It is, yeah. They are. Fortunately, some of the worst policies, they weren't all good, they weren't all bad policies, but some of the worst were struck down by the Supreme Court in 1935, the NRA law, which was basically fascism, really, trying to organize the entire business of this country into cartels. The Supreme Court said that's going a little too far. And the Agricultural Act, the Supreme Court struck down partly, but we are still paying huge subsidies to farmers, many of whom are quite rich.
See, now this is one of my favorite parts of your book, where you talked about how FDR comes out with this incredible speech that everybody always remembers. The only fear we have to fear is fear itself, you know, and he's encouraging all these people. But you go on to talk about the rest of the speech, where he basically calls all the bankers and all the business people a bunch of hoodlums and crooks, and they're greedy capitalists. And, you know, so he didn't encourage everybody in that talk, did he? And yet these are the people that, you know, I'm sure they're not perfect. Nobody's perfect, but I don't think they were what he claimed they to be. Well, sounded like the Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah, it was pure politics, demagogic politics, really. And, you know, you you want to get the economy to recover, so you go out and insult the people who are trying to invest and cause the economy to recover. That doesn't make much sense.
Yeah, it's like a similar sound to it from 2008 until 2016, right?
Yeah.
You didn't create that business.
Right. And Elizabeth Warren, you know, out there beating up on everybody who runs a business or runs a bank or anything like that as if she's the only virtuous person in the country. She just drives me crazy.
Sure.
I think I'm in your camp on that, too.
You know, George, you know, this is my experience. I'm a business owner myself, and I work with a lot of business owners, helping them with their personal finance and so forth. And what I tend to find is that most business owners will sacrifice themselves before they'll sacrifice their employees. Now, that's not true of every business, but right. I find it to be the majority, not the minority. Now, do you have any experience with that?
Well, I think that's true. I mean, the guy who built the Sheraton Hotel chain once made the his name was Ernest Henderson. He once made the remark that if a hotel burns down, you lose the building. But if you have the people, you can rebuild. But if you lose all the people, there's nothing there, and you have a hotel, it's no use to you. So he put people first. He always tried to make his employees comfortable, and they were very loyal to him, and that's why he succeeded so well.
Well, what about the, you know, let's go back to the 1929, 1930 Depression and so forth. We were on a gold standard. Do you think that had something to do with the Depression? And do you think that the gold standard is something that we, any country, should even think about in today's world?
Well, it probably had something to do with the Depression, but not as much as some people think. I mean, the gold standard was breaking down well before the Depression, mainly because of World War One. The Europeans, particularly Britain, ran up huge war debts. And so the flow of gold was kind of one way there for a while, all coming to the United States. And so it's a long story, but no, I don't really think. I think what caused the crash, which is a different thing from the Depression, what caused the crash was we simply ran out the credit cycle. We had too much debt, and everybody was pulling in their horns, and the market crashed. You know, it's crashed before, and it's crashed since. It crashed in 1978 with absolutely no consequences. And my argument is that the government policies that followed the crash caused the Depression.
All right, George, you got to hold up for us because we're going to take our second pause, and then we're going to come back and we'll get more into when the New Deal came to town with George Malone. But right now we have to take a pause with traffic. We'll be right back. Money, Riches, and Wealth.
Yeah.
And we're back. Money, Riches, and Wealth here with Christopher John O'Shea and George Malone. And we're talking about his new book, When the New Deal Came to Town, and his article, America Can't Escape the Debt Vortex. George, one of the things, you grew up in the Great Depression, a little town, I think it was called Whiteland, right? Indiana?
Yes.
And the favorite part that I liked about Whiteland, Indiana, is the stock market in 1929 crashes. And your town newspapers don't even report it. How do you do that?
That's right. Our county seat was Franklin, Indiana, and the Franklin Star, one of my colleagues made a search of the microfiche of the Franklin Star at that time and could find no mention of the stock market crash.
Hopefully they were
surprising, really, because very few people owned stock back then, and you know, they were invested in their farms and their livestock and those kinds of things. And And so they didn't care too much about what happened in Wall Street.
Yeah, and you know, the other interesting thing was you talked about, and I never thought about this, but in a town like Whiteland, you know, life went on as normal. It wasn't like in the big cities where so many people were unemployed and so forth. You didn't feel it the same way that the big cities did.
Well, I think the problem, I mean, the advantage we had in small farm villages, which, you know, that was pretty much about half of the population at that time. The country's population was about 123,000, and about half of people lived in rural areas. And so the nice thing about living on a farm is you can feed yourself and shelter yourself as long as you can hang on to the farm. And the people in the cities didn't have that advantage, so they were somewhat at the mercy of the layoffs that occurred in corporations.
So in the 1930s, during the Great Depression, here comes FDR, and he makes all kinds of moves to try to improve the economy, which you're saying is probably the wrong thing for government to do. Let's talk about one of them, the Glass-Steagall Act, was probably one, in my opinion, is a good thing when you're talking about federally insured deposits. What's your opinion?
Well, the Glass-Steagall Act, I think, was probably a good move at that time. I mean, it segregated commercial and investment banking, and even though the investment bankers had very little to do with the crash, they kind of got the blame for it. But it seemed that some of the New Deal measures, like deposit insurance, and I think Glass-Steagall to some extent, did calm the banking industry down a bit, and it stabilized things. I had a lot of doubts about the bank holiday, where Roosevelt just simply closed the banks and sent in inspectors to examine all of them, because some people couldn't get their money for, not very much of their money at least, for quite a few months. So I'm not sure that worked out very well, but some of the banking things they did seemed to work okay.
Do you think that the banks should be broken up in America today, 2017, where the money that the federal government insures and guarantees as deposits should be run in a totally distinctly different type of business than those businesses that are much more risky?
I'm sorry, Chris, go say that again. I lost you there somewhere.
So, you know, you've got your deposits, and so I go into a bank, I've got $100,000 in there, and they're guaranteeing that. So should the simple part of banking, which is just deposits and loans, be separated from investment banking, which, you know, like a J.P. Morgan does a lot of things and, you know, and so forth, which is a lot more risky and could bring the bank down, even though the lending didn't bring the bank down? Do you think they should be separated?
Well, I'm not sure how you would do that today. Actually, the current Banking Act in 2010, had the Volcker provision in it for sort of re-separating those two functions. And the people trying to implement that have had a very rough time trying to figure out how to do it, because everything is so much integrated today, and it's very hard to know what a commercial bank should do and what it shouldn't do and all that sort of thing. So it gets very complicated, and my idea is to put the banks, to remove the idea of too big to fail from the banks and let them figure it out for themselves.
Huh. I like that idea.
Sure. I would have thought after 2008, when all that stuff was going on, again, they thought the domino effect and all that, but should they, you know, should they have let somebody fail?
I think they should have let all those big guys fail personally.
Yeah.
Would you have let them fail there, George?
Well,
would you have let J.P. Morgan and Merrill Lynch and Goldman Sachs
AIG.
And AIG go down?
Fail is bankruptcy. I mean, and you know, companies go into bankruptcy all the time and
sure.
come out, and you know, so it's not such a disaster. It can be handled.
Well, and the funny thing is that by propping them all up during that period of time, they made them bigger, and they made them more of a systemic danger to some degree.
Yeah,
that was the funny part about it. So anyway,
I've heard things.
Well, yeah, absolutely, because they gave the big banks, the too big to fail banks, an implicit guarantee, and all the money started swinging from the smaller banks to the big banks. So they created a monster there.
And so, like you said, whenever government comes in and makes their decisions, they think they're doing good, and they're actually in the long run hurting. And
absolutely.
And it's kind of like this Sweden article I brought up. This lady's coming in, and she's, you know, she's like, I'm doing wonderful, fantastic things. Look at all this good stuff. But what's going to happen is sooner or later, it's going to run out of steam. That's what always happens when you have something unproductive like government making decisions.
Well, they're going back to the Sweden of 20 years ago when they were in serious trouble. So nothing changes.
I remember another article not too long ago, George, was talking and comparing, and this is the typical, so many people in the press are just downright liberal socialists, and they write these articles, and they were doing this comparison between Nebraska and Kansas, and they're saying all these great tax deductions that Kansas passed and all this pro-business stuff that Kansas passed, it's failing, and Nebraska, which has gone the opposite direction, is going boom, gangbusters, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, that drives me crazy because they're looking at it over maybe 6 months or a year or two and saying, well, this is a failure.
So they want a new Kansas-Nebraska Act, I guess, or something.
I guess.
So, as we're thinking and we're talking about the aftermath of the 08 debt, the credit boom ending and the market crash, and where we are now, it always seems strange that you take on more debt after you've had the end of a credit boom end. How does this end? How does it end? What does the next 5-10 years look like?
Well, I'm a little concerned about the current condition. As I say, the debt level. Consumer debt, consumers pulled in their horns after the 2008 crash, and so the consumer debt level went down, but it started picking up in about 2010, and it's getting up there pretty high, and you're beginning to see some signs of that. New home sales dropped off in mm-hmm. April. Auto loans, bankers are getting a little tighter with their auto loans, and auto debt, credit card debt is very high. So we may be getting close to the end of a credit cycle, and that usually means a downturn in the business cycle. So that's a little bit of a concern.
You got to hold with us for a sec, George. We're going to take our last pause here for traffic, and we're going to come back, finish up our last segment. It always flies when we're talking with a guest that's as good as George. But right now, we have to take our traffic pause, and we're going to be right back. Money, Riches, and Wealth.
Yeah.
And we're back. Money, Riches, and Wealth. We're here with George Malone, and his book, When the New Deal Came to Town, is talking about, you know, I say it often in this show that if you're a serious investor, a serious personal finance person, you need to study history because history will always never repeat exactly, but it'll definitely rhyme a lot with the past. So by understanding history, you can understand what could possibly happen in the future. And that's what the greatness of this book is this, it's just such a, you know, great understanding of what the government did back in the 30s that caused even worse problems. So, you know, George, you know, I remember reading something that Franklin Delano Roosevelt's economic advisor for all those 10 years that he had been passing all these wonderful policies with Roosevelt. And all of a sudden, it was around 1939 or so, and he says to Roosevelt, we've done all these things. We've thrown everything at it, and we're no further ahead than what we were 8 years ago or 9 years ago or whatever it was. You know, do you, is that true? Did I get that right?
Yes. In fact, I think there was a negative rate of capital investment in the 1930s. So absolutely, we were stalled for 10 years, and we had a second crash in 1937. So. And that one was probably also caused by policy, because the New Deal, that was kind of, they called it the Second New Deal, which imposed a tax on excess profits, as they called it. And that just shut down investment again, and so we crashed again. And so the New Deal didn't have a very good record in the 1930s.
So do you believe that World War II is what brought us out of it, and why, you know, I mean, they borrowed a boatload of money to get through World War II?
There's a good argument that we didn't really come out of, I mean, a lot of things happened in World War II. But the most important thing in my view, or at least one of the most important things, was it restored our confidence in capitalism. The New Deal had been basically making politics against capitalism during the 1930s. But when Roosevelt saw in 1940 that things were getting pretty bad in the world, in the warfare going on in Europe and so forth, he all of a sudden became very friendly towards business, because he knew business corporations, because he realized that, hey, I'm going to need these guys. We have to mobilize. And, boy, they did mobilize. They sure, there was a spectacular mobilization by American industry.
Yeah.
We came out of the war with a far more positive attitude towards business corporations than was going on than we were having in the 1930s.
So here's the 1930s, and Herbert Hoover, Republican, is the protectionist. And then we go up into the 1970s and 80s, and you got Reagan and Bush especially, and they're the free market, global free market traders, and the Democrats were the protectionists. And now here we are back in 2017, and the Democrats are the ones talking free trade and so forth. And here's Trump gets elected on the grounds of, I'm not interested in too free trade. I want it to be strictly, you know, it's got to be solely in favor of the United States and so forth.
Well, I have some problems. I think Trump is getting a bad rap. The anti-Trump crowd down in Washington is getting kind of unhinged. But I do disagree with Trump on his trade policies. I'm very much in favor of free trade. And I think, you know, some of this may be cosmetic. I think he could probably renegotiate NAFTA without doing too much damage, maybe some improvement. But I wish he would get off this protectionist kick and get on to other things.
Yeah. Is it possible that he just used that as a negotiating tool? Because so far, he doesn't seem to have, actually implemented as much protectionism as he has just deal-making.
Yeah, I think that's a good argument. And also, I'm not sure that he was elected because of his protectionism. I think
right.
it was a sure. much broader thing than that. I kind of have the feeling maybe that wasn't even the most important thing, but I think what was important was that there was just simply a reaction to the kind of culture that has been created by the Democratic Party.
Well, and I also think they probably put up their worst candidate they could have ever put up.
Well, they did
them.
That, of course.
Yeah. Sure. Sure.
So, yeah. So do you, you know, what types of policies, you know, do you think he's going to be able to get tax reform through? I think that's critical. It's
well,
needed. It's so badly needed.
I think there's a pretty general consensus on on lowering the corporate tax rate. I think they should at least be able to do that because it's pretty obvious that the high corporate tax rate has been causing corporations to leave their overseas earnings overseas rather than repatriating them. Now, they won't repatriate all of them, but it'll simply make if the corporate tax is brought down, it'll make the system more fluid and more efficient, I think.
Yeah, but, you know, what irritates me is, you know, I saw an article the other day from, I never can say his name, the Treasury Secretary, is it Mnuchin?
Mnuchin sounds.
Mnuchin?
Yeah.
Is that how you say it?
Well, sure. I know either Mnuchin, I guess.
Yeah.
Mnuchin.
It sounds more plausible.
Okay.
It's about 50-50 people pronounce it out there.
All right. Well, I saw him the other day, and he writes a thing about the tax policy, and he says, well, we can't guarantee that a lot of billionaires aren't going to benefit from the new tax law. Why don't they just write a tax law that's straightforward and fair to everyone, that no matter how much money you make, you're going to be paying 10, 20, 30% or whatever the heck it is? Why don't they just do it? Why do they have to?
Well, sure, but right now, for the last 20 years now, they've been beating on the drum of it has to be a progressive tax code. If not, then the rich are getting away with things.
But they can do a minor progression. They don't, and it'd
gotcha.
Still be a good thing for everyone. You know, it'd be relatively easy to do, and they can get these guys off their back. You know, they open the door against themselves.
Actually, the tax code is pretty progressive right now, and in fact, it became even more progressive with the rewrite that George W. Bush did.
You're right, sure.
In 2003. But this class warfare, I mean, you know, we need a few billionaires because they don't hide their money in a sock. They invest it. We need investment. And so that's how the capitalist system works. And why should we begrudge them their wealth? They can only eat so much or buy so many boats or something.
Sure.
They're not all that much better off than we are.
So one final question. The prospects you think of returning to supply-side economics, because the book you wrote right after the crash of 08 was The Great Money Binge, Spending Our Way to Socialism, and you talk in there about how what we've done, what Bernanke et al. Have done, mirrored what happened in Obama, mirrored what happened in the 30s, that you're thinking that government Keynesianism was going to take us out of the problems, and it just makes it worse, versus what happened in the 80s and 90s with what Reagan unleashed with supply-side stuff, really helped everything just explode. What's the prospects going forward of that being implemented?
Well, I think we have to unravel some of the things that the progressives did when they got into power in 2010. Certainly, Obamacare has to be fixed. And the banking law could certainly stand some improvement. As I say, too big to fail is not a good concept.
Yeah.
And so there are a lot of things that need to be fixed. Tax reform, that's one of the great things that Reagan was able
unfortunately,
to do.
George.
Democratic cooperation was to reform the tax system.
Yeah, we're out of time, George. And I really appreciate your being with us, and it was incredibly informative. I wish we could have you back. I hope you'll do that with us.
Sure, I'll be happy to.
Well, anyway, we're finished for tonight. This is Drew Tignanelli saying God bless.